Jesus said, "Don't let your hearts be troubled. You trust God, trust also in me." Now today, this is Holy Week. To get ready for, to be prepared for Good Friday, I want to give extended thoughts to Good Friday, because when Jesus spoke these words, it was precisely when he was going to the cross and he was going to die. And he wanted his disciples to understand as much about that as they could. A lot of people wonder, why did Jesus have to die? And sometimes they think it's like there was this law that God would not be allowed to forgive people unless Jesus died. But of course, there is no law that is above God. So what I want to look at today is actually the day itself, Friday itself, and all the players who were involved, and why is it that Jesus himself died? What was going on that day? Because it was beginning with that day and reflecting on it that over time allowed people to understand a greater significance in Jesus' death. And in this passage, John 14 and 15, that we're studying, Jesus makes this great statement: greater love has no one than this, that a person should lay down their life for their friends. So, extended thoughts now. We're going to work backwards to understand what exactly was happening on Friday and who is in control. It's Friday. Outside of the gates of Jerusalem, there are three crosses. On those crosses hang the body of two thieves, not just thieves exactly. We'll come back to that. The middle cross is empty. Its victim has already died and been taken down. Over the middle cross hangs a sign, "Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews." It's written in three languages, Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. And the question is, why did he die? How did this Jesus, meek and mild, blesser of children, friend of sinners, end up being executed? Friday is a day of mixed motives and odd alliances, secret meetings, cynical PR moves, explosive emotions. It is the most famous and influential death of human history, whatever you think about it, and it turns out there were many very powerful forces and characters at work. And we'll look at them. They ended up crushing him, but when you keep trying to understand, it is not clear that the people who thought they were in charge were really in charge. Everybody on Good Friday had an agenda, as every human being has an agenda. And we're going to walk through the major events, working backwards, looking at the major players, and ask, what did they all want? And whose will triumphed? Now, Rome would say Jesus died because he was a threat to Rome. In our day, a lot of people think of Christ as Jesus' last name, but it was not. It was a title. It's from a Greek word, krio, which means to anoint. The Christ was the anointed one, or the Messiah. Now imagine for a moment, this will take some imagination, that the Middle East is a volatile place where religious fervor and politics get mixed up in dangerous ways. And there are crowds around Jesus in Jerusalem, and they're waiting for precisely a Messiah who would lead the people in a glorious battle to overthrow Rome, clean up the corruption in the temple, make Israel the envy of the world. And what you have to understand to get the impact of Friday is that there were many, many would-be, wannabe messiahs at that time. Acts chapter 5, verse 36 says, "Some time ago, Theudas appeared, claiming to be somebody, and about 400 men rallied to him. He was killed." A historian named Josephus tells us that Theudas was called a messiah. He claimed to be able to part the River Jordan, claimed to be able to make the walls of Jerusalem fall down. He ended up being captured by Rome and decapitated in front of everybody. There's another would-be messiah who's talked about in the book of Acts also. Judas the Galilean appeared in the days of the census and led a band of people in revolt. He too was killed. Now, Judas the Galilean founded a group called the Zealots. He said, "God alone is the God of Israel. Caesar's an idol. Therefore, Israel should pay no taxes to Rome." Imagine a group of people getting all worked up over taxes. And the zealot agenda was to incite a critical mass of Israelites to take up arms against Rome, and they believed that God would honor this faith and deliver his people. So Judas the Galilean did this. He took up arms, he was captured, his followers were captured, 2,000 of them were crucified, and their crosses were left up. If anybody got any right ideas about not paying taxes, Rome has plenty more crosses. And by the way, this happened when Jesus was a boy. Judas was from the region of Galilee. Jesus grew up in a town called Nazareth. Nazareth was in Galilee. Now the zealots kept going. Judas had two sons, and when they grew up, people thought maybe they were the Messiah. And so they got crucified. He had a grandson named Menachem. He was called the Messiah, set himself up as a king. He was eventually attacked in the temple and tortured and executed. Now, how do you know if you are the Messiah? Well, it's kind of like you might remember the story, the legend of King Arthur. There was a sword in the stone, and the king of England would be the person who was able to pull that sword out of the stone. You don't know if that's you until you try. So, in Israel, the Messiah would be the guy who could beat Rome. You wouldn't know until you could try. And if you tried and you got crucified, then it turns out you're not the Messiah. And this happened time and time and time again. People thought, maybe it's me. There were maybe 18 separate would-be Messiahs around Jesus' time that we know of. Sometimes they would even wear a crown. Often they and or their followers would loot the Roman arsenal or the palaces. Now, Rome, of course, would see them as thieves and brigands. They regarded themselves more like Robin Hood, taking back from Rome what should have been theirs. The Roman word for them was the word lestes. You might remember a character in the Bible who's called the thief on the cross. He was not up there for shoplifting. He was part of one of these anti-Rome movements. He was crucified so that Rome could send a message to the crowds. Jesus was crucified. And yet and yet and yet, he was not this kind of Messiah or king. In fact, he deliberately rejects this role. This is, again, whatever you think about Jesus, he was utterly, fundamentally unique, distinct from all the characters in his day. He deliberately rejects the role of Messiah King. John 11 talks about how Jesus, knowing that they, the crowds, intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew into the hills by himself. Unlike any of those others would-be messiahs, he refused to lift a finger against Rome. He refused the way of violent resistance. So why did he die? Well, now we have to back up to an earlier scene on Friday when the chief priests brought Jesus before a man named Pontius Pilate. This is maybe 8 o'clock in the morning on that day where there's a hearing. Pilate ruled Judea basically as a lackey for Caesar. His title was procurator, and he had to deal with a bunch of difficult forces, all of whom thought they could be in control on that Friday. There were the chief priests. They collaborated. They were Jewish, but they collaborated enough with Rome to be allowed to be in charge of the temple where all that money changed hands. They couldn't get so close to Rome that the crowds would hate them, but they couldn't get so close to the Israel crowds that Rome would arrest them. And folks in the Bible called Sadducees, they're associated with this group. They got to thread the needle. They're playing both ends against the middle. And then there were the Pharisees. They believed in purity. They were devoted to Torah. They believed that the chief priests were way too cozy with Rome, that Israel would be restored when enough people obeyed Torah enough. And then another group were the zealots, and their approach was to fight. They believed that Rome would be overthrown by violent military action. And sometimes they overlapped a bit with the Pharisees. And then there was another group called the Essenes, and their strategy was to withdraw. You've ever heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls? They were kept by a community that believed that Israel was so corrupt, the only solution was complete withdrawal so that this new community would be unsullied, untouched. Then God would come and torch their enemies. The Essenes would not come to the temple, would not pay taxes. Rome couldn't get any money for them. They all knew. The chief priests' strategies collaborate. The Pharisee strategy is purify. The zealot strategy is to fight. The Essene strategy is to withdraw. They all knew that to be for God means to be against Rome. They all hated Rome. They often hated each other. Pilate's job is to keep a lid on this mess. And he was as ruthless as anybody. Ancient world was a pretty ruthless place. We get glimpses of this in the New Testament. Some people came up and told Jesus about the Galileans Pilate had killed while they were at worship, mixing their blood with the blood of the sacrifices on the altar. This is Luke 13, verse 1. So Pilate's a ruthless guy. The temple in Jerusalem is ground zero for rebellion. And apparently Pilate thought some Jews might revolt, so he slaughtered them during their most holy moment. That's what's written about here in Luke 13:1. That's Pilate. Another time, Pilate stole money from the temple to pay for an aqueduct. And when some people protested about that, he had them executed. Those people were from Galilee. Remember where Jesus was from? Eventually, he slaughtered so many people near Samaria, and the unrest got so great that he was fired by Caesar and he was sent back to Rome. Another writer named Philo said Pilate's rule was marked by, this is a direct quote, bribery, insults, robbery, supreme cruelty, executions without trial, and a furious temper. This was the man in whose hands Jesus' life now rested on this Friday. Chief priests bring Jesus to Pilate. They say, Luke 23, verse 2, we have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes our paying taxes to Caesar and claims to be the Christ, our King. Now, this is bogus. Chief priests couldn't give a fig about raising taxes for Caesar. They're just trying to put pressure on Pilate to do what they want him to do for altogether different reasons. Pilate resists the chief priests. Because he always resists the chief priests. Because the last thing he wants is for them to think they can dictate policy to him. When he finds out Jesus is from Galilee, he refers the whole deal to Herod because Galilee is under Herod's jurisdiction. Herod basically says, I'm not touching this with a 10-foot pole. So when that doesn't work, Pilate turns to the crowd. And he says, I can release Jesus, who's clearly harmless, or Barabbas, an anti-Roman terrorist. Pilate is going to go over the chief priest's head to the crowd, but the crowd wants Barabbas released. No surprise, Barabbas is willing to kill Romans, and Jesus is not. Finally, in a scene that would become very famous, it's very theatrical, Pilate publicly washes his hands, not because he's conscience-stricken and wants to have clean. He could care less about this powerless, harmless dime-store Messiah in front of him. His agenda is he wants to maintain the upper hand over the chief priests and the temple. Legally, Pilate should be in control. But what's going on here, it's all about power and money, as it always is. The chief priests are playing their trump card. They say to Pilate, if you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anybody who claims to be king, Jesus, is no friend of Caesar. We have no king but Caesar. Now, what does Caesar want? Caesar wanted corn. Sounds strange, but Rome had to eat. And Caesar grew increasingly dependent on grain from Egypt and the Middle East. That was like their breadbasket. Grain was to the Middle East in that day what oil is in our day. Why did Jesus die? One way to look at it, he died for corn. He died so that Caesar could get his grain supply. Pilate cannot risk Caesar thinking that Pilate is soft on terrorism, so he asked Jesus, are you king of the Jews? Now, this is so ironic as we reflect on this day and on Jesus and his ministry and his identity and his life. Never been anybody like him. Earlier in his ministry, over and over and over, people wondered about this. Is this the king? Is this the Messiah? Is this the deliverer? And all he ever had to do was say, yes, I'm the Messiah, and people would have fought to the death for him. That's what Palm Sunday was about. Passover was all about how Moses defied Pharaoh and led Israel to rebel against their slavery, and God destroyed Egypt's army. So when this young leader, Jesus, marches openly into Jerusalem at Passover, everybody assume it's to lead the revolt. He's going to be the son of David, the son of Moses, the warrior king. But Jesus will not fight. And that's why it's no mystery, it's no conundrum that the crowds turned against him so quickly after Palm Sunday. So over and over in his life, you might have noticed in the Bible, often when Jesus does some miraculous thing, he tells the person to keep it quiet. He doesn't want it to spread too quickly that he's the Messiah, because he knows everybody, when they hear Messiah, they're going to think, oh man, grab a sword. Now, when it's too late, when there is no chance of an army rising to defend him, when his life cannot be spared through this means, now finally he gives a definitive answer, Luke 23:3. Yes, it is as you say. Are you king of the Jews? Yep. Now finally says it. Pilate pronounces the sentence over Jesus, but he didn't want this. So who really was making this happen? We have to back up further. Why do the chief priests want Jesus dead? Shortly before Good Friday, after Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead, the Pharisees and the chief priests have a meeting. Here is this man performing many miraculous signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. This is John 11, verses 47 and following. Then Caiaphas, high priest, spoke up. You do not realize that it is better for you, you priests, you Pharisees, that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. Priests knew that if unrest got too strong in Jerusalem, Rome would swoop in and lay the hammer down. And by the way, Caiaphas was not wrong about this. As you might know, by the year 70 AD, Israel cranked up one revolt too many, one wannabe Messiah too many, and Rome came in and decimated Jerusalem and leveled the temple and virtually destroyed the nation in a scene of unspeakable cruelty. The chief priests knew that Jesus was not a military rebel, but they also knew that his teaching and his movement was a threat. He was claiming the kingdom of God was now present, not through them, not through the temple sacrifices, not through adherence to Torah, which separated Jews from Gentiles, not through withdrawal, but through Jesus himself. He was telling everybody that God's presence, God's blessing, God's forgiveness, God's guidance, the life of an untroubled heart is available through him and his new community and his new way. They could not let this stand. So we back up earlier, maybe 4 o'clock in the morning, there's a trial involving the Sanhedrin. They have Jesus arrested, and they have their own little court proceeding before they took him to Pilate. This happened before daybreak, we're told. It was secret. It was possibly illegal because the leaders have a real delicate task now. They got to get the crowds to hate Jesus. They got to get Pilate to crucify Jesus. And the way to get Pilate to crucify Jesus is to say that Jesus is a danger to Rome. But of course, that message, Jesus could bring down Rome, that would make the crowds love Jesus. That's what the crowds wanted. So the religious leaders had to create two charges: blasphemy, which would make the crowds hate him, and treason, which would make Rome kill him. And they couldn't get this done. It was an inept trial. It was clownishly buffoonish if it weren't for the tragic nature of it. Mark 14:56 says, the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they couldn't find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Once again, all Jesus has to do is remain silent. And once again, he does not. He makes no attempt to correct the false witnesses, no attempt to re-explain his mission. He sits in silence while they mock him. He makes just one statement: I am. And you will see the Son of Man descending on the clouds. He's not talking about a literal picture up in the sky. That was apocalyptic language that was used to describe the power of God being made manifest in human events on earth. He's not saying they will see a body coming from the sky. The image they all knew was claiming that God is now present and at work uniquely in Jesus. And with that, Jesus hands them what they need for their verdict. He does their work for them, which they were too incompetent to do. Why would he do that? So we have to back up once more on Friday. Before the cross, before the soldiers, before the beatings, before the meeting with Pilate, before the trial with the chief priests, before the arrest, maybe 2 o'clock in the morning, in the garden, Jesus is in a garden. Don't let your heart be troubled. God is up to something. You remember the story of the human race, the story of the first Adam, began in a garden, and now the story of the second Adam will end there. When he is in the garden, Jesus still has options. He could fight like the zealots. He has charisma and power. Look what happened on Palm Sunday. Isn't Rome evil? Isn't fighting evil and a good and brave thing? He could do that. He could withdraw like the Essenes. He could be safe. A lot of people could go with him. He could start with a clean slate, a new community. He could make a deal with Pilate. Maybe he could influence Rome from the inside. Maybe, given his brilliance and his strength and his power, what a wonderful thing it would be if the Roman Empire could be won by Jesus safely for God. He could collaborate with the chief priests. Think how his teaching would be accepted if he had the temple system as his platform, as his network. He could call his father to send angels. A lot of people could be run to the right side by an act of miraculous power. He had options. Doesn't take any of them. You ever troubled by our world? Ever troubled by not knowing what to do next? Who is this man? This one, lone, deserted, vulnerable man. Again, whatever you think of God or the story of the resurrection or so, we're just on Friday today. This one lone, deserted, vulnerable man says, I know what I must do. And he says to his father, not my will, but yours be done. I will not fight. I will not run. I will not deal. I will not dazzle. I will die. Jesus believed that the real messianic battle would consist of dying at the hands of Rome. This is a staggering thought. He was drawing wrath and vengeance on himself and thereby saving others. And again, I'm not doing a real abstract theological treatment of this now. Over time, people came to understand in ways that are full of mystery and layers and lots of different images and pictures that Jesus was dying for us. He was experiencing death on our behalf. He was dying for the forgiveness of our sins and for the defeat of cosmic enemies. But it starts with the real situation on Good Friday. That's where you have to start thinking about what's going on. He was drawing wrath and vengeance on himself and thereby saving others. Rome would always execute rebels. So Jesus is dying in the place of rebels, even though he was innocent. Barabbas is saved by Jesus' death. On the other hand, Jerusalem was filled with crowds wanting to kill Romans. One word from Jesus and they would have done it. Jesus would not give that word. So the crowd said to crucify Jesus. He was dying to save Roman soldiers. And, you know, we picture sometimes from movies or whatever these, you know, big, powerful men from Rome. Mostly these would have been relatively young boys from nearby Samaria or places like that. These were, you know, low status people. And Jesus dies to save them. Jesus' disciples deserted him. Jesus knew that if Jesus ran, even if he got safe, the Romans would track down his disciples and kill them. So Jesus died for his disciples to save them. If Jesus had led Jerusalem into battle against the soldiers, he knew it was only a matter of time before Rome would have crushed Jerusalem as it ultimately did. So he was dying for Jerusalem. Jesus had one agenda, and that was love. He did it because it was his choice to die, and he died for love. Greater love has no one than this, that a person should lay down their life for their friends. And of course, the most staggering love of all is not just love your friends, it's love your enemies. Jesus said in the garden. I will lay down my life for them. I will die for all of them. And then a little community can be formed by the power of sacrificial love. And that little community, with no money and no army and no strength and no territory and no influence and no network, and that little community can change the world. And whatever you think of Jesus, that is precisely what happened. Jesus, his breathtaking courage, his inexplicable love, sized up a situation that defeated every human attempt at correction. He identified what would be needed to bring redemption, and it cost him everything, and he turned out to be exactly right. Pilate writes it in Hebrew, Latin, and Greek. Pilate writes the gospel so the whole world can read it. Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. In the language of ultimate government power, Latin, and ultimate learning and education, Greek, and ultimate religion, Hebrew. Jesus outthought, outmaneuvered every group and every power broker, but not just that, way better than that, he outloved everybody. And over time, his followers came to understand it wasn't just that. On Friday, he was somehow dying for the world. You and me. This is his statement. I lay down my life for the sheep. No one takes it from me. Not Pilate, not Herod, not the soldiers, not the chief priests. No one takes it from me. I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down. I have authority to take it up again. This command I have received from my Father. My Father and I have worked all this out. On Friday, in the garden, the decision is made. God will suffer. God, in the person of Jesus, will die. On Friday, God shows love, but God demonstrated his love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. That's why Jesus died on Friday, for love. Don't let your heart be troubled.
Hey, before you click off, be sure to hit that subscribe button here, and that will help us reach more people with our channel. You can also visit becomenew.com, where you might want to subscribe to our email or text. It'll give you more information and resources for each episode. Become